There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Pierre de Lancin. The early 2000s in the UK saw a revival of burlesque, a traditional performance form that proliferated 100 years ago. This revival took place in cabaret stages, in fetish clubs, and in experimental performance spaces, and eventually reached the mainstream. Many female performers have fought to make neo-burlesque a site of expression of the sexual identities, subverting the idea that the work or their bodies were bad or dirty. Some confronted stigma and the resistance of audiences. A new book, Bad Girls, Dirty Bodies, Sex, Performance, and Safe Femininity by Gemma Comain, explores the social, sexual, and political significance of women who are labeled as bad or dirty. Through in-depth case studies with artists such as Empress Starr, Rubber Doll, or Doris Latrine, the book challenges the notion that sexual, slutty, bad, or dirty women are not worth listening to. Gemma Comain is a senior lecturer in media and communication at Birmingham City University, and I'm very happy that she joins me now to discuss her research. Welcome to the show, Gemma.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Gemma, your book asks some pretty fundamental questions about what forms of femininity are allowed and valorized by which environments. But before we get into any of this detail, I'd like to ask you to tell us a little bit about your research interests and how you came to work in this field.
Yeah, well, I've always been fascinated with identities, bodies, lifestyles that kind of deviated from the norm. And in many ways, I can answer this question in so many different kind of connected ways, and I'll go through those now. Growing up in a very conservative setting, a very kind of Catholic, heterosexual cis setting, I was always fascinated with things that the church would disapprove of, or my family would disapprove of. And that fascination developed through my teens when I started to socialise with more people who I felt were more like me. So queers, kinky folk, trans folk, etc. And, you know, these individuals, these groups that I felt that I could belong and be myself in, I felt that an experience that those outside would think very negatively about people's identities, lifestyles that deviated from the norm. And for me, it was a fascination to kind of explore, you know, why is that the case? Why is it that society in general have very kind of binary views around gender? Why do they have very binary views around what a person can do with their body? So again, that kind of drive was first of all from a personal experience, but also from a professional point of view as well. I kind of started to engage with, through my degrees, exploring kind of identity politics, exploring subcultures, particularly fetish, BDSM, kinky cultures, and how these spaces opened up opportunities for folk to explore self-identity, etc. But at the same time, looking at how wider society disapproved of these particular perspectives, and also at the subcultural level, how there's certain policing going on around people's performance of femininity. So there's different routes that I've taken to kind of come to this stage in terms of looking at alternative forms of femininity, again, from my own kind of standing point as a queer woman, but also how my friends were treated in relation to their femininity and kind of sexuality too. Also, there has been, and I noticed, a rise in popularity in kind of burlesque in the late 90s, early 2000s, particularly in fetish and BDSM clubs. And I was really interested in what this rise meant in terms of femininity, sexual expression, also ways to challenge norms around the body, what women can succeed at, and yeah, all kind of context relating to identity, I guess.
Fascinating. Well, as a fellow Catholic at origin, I sympathise with some of those interests for sure. But you mentioned burlesque, and just before we get into the crux of the book, it would be good to give a listener some kind of an understanding of what it is that we mean by burlesque and some of its histories.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, for listeners who want to look at a more in-depth historical kind of story of burlesque, Michelle Baldwin has written quite extensively on this subject matter, and others as well. But I'll give you a quick tour of burlesque history. So burlesque itself has its origins in the UK in terms of cabaret, vaudeville, you know, kind of that kind of slapstick comedy as well. So in the 1800s, you had like the rise of, you know, kind of burlesque. You had in the late 1800s, early 1900s, Lydia Thompson and the British Bronze, who went from the UK to America to perform on stage their burlesque. So it's a striptease with an emphasis on tease. Earlier forms of burlesque, you know, you wouldn't have the types of burlesque that you see today. So, you know, the nipple tassels on show, because it would be seen as too obscene. But it was, you know, still quite a racy kind of type of performance art. During the early 1900s to about the 1930s, you had a massive explosion in popularity of burlesque, and this kind of comes also at the same time in the growth of the entertainment industry, a little bit more exposable income. You know, this, you know, there are other external factors that enabled kind of burlesque as an art form to flourish on stages in theatres. And there's a few folk who argue that, you know, during the 1950s in particular, that it's the kind of heyday of burlesque, where you had pinups, where you had, you know, really massive superstars, including Betty Page, one of the world's most wonderful pinups, and also fetish and BDSM models as well. However, during the 1950s, with the burlesque, with emphasis on tease, you know, fan dances, beautiful teasing off clothes. It's very tasteful strip tease. And I'm not trying to get into binaries here, because every form of tease for me is of equal value, but perhaps we'll get into conversations later about the hierarchies around what tease matters to some folk and what tease is seen to be less of an art form. However, coming back to the history of burlesque, during the 1950s in America, there is starting to be a bit of decline in the popularity of burlesque. And you had moralists from the church and also, from the government and councils who were just not that happy with the vice that is perpetuated apparently by burlesque and these really risque women doing really morally corrosive things. They're corrupting, they're corrupting people, these burlesquers. But also during this period, you've got the rise of go-go dancing in the 1960s and 50s. And 60s, the growth of go-go dancing, the growth of gentlemen's clubs, also the growth of kind of pornography, porn mags, etc. So burlesque itself was seen to be a bit of a vice, but also there is a growing demand, a growing kind of culture of entertainment focusing on porn, other forms of striptease, and burlesque kind of became quite boring and quite sidelined to this other style of kind of stripping and erotics. And you've got obviously kind of the sex wars of the 60s onwards, where there's massive battles around kind of misogyny, the female body, issues around gentlemen's clubs and pornography, etc. So burlesque itself kind of falls out of the way to this more pressing kind of critique of kind of porn culture and sexualization in other kind of contexts. However, interestingly, during the 1990s, there is this kind of revival of burlesque. And in the 1990s, it's quite a interesting period. And again, not seeing burlesque or the revival of it in isolation from wider popular culture, from the rise of girl power with the Spice Girls, women being framed as sexual consumers. You've got Anne Summers, you've got dildos and vibrators available on the high street. You've got more kind of focus on female empowerment, so this kind of shift to girl power, independent femininity, and there's this rise, an interesting rise of burlesque within kind of in the 90s into the 2000s around fetish clubs, but also kind of independent burlesque nights, where a space is created for women whose bodies perhaps aren't necessarily always promoted in mainstream media. So you've got women with tattoos, heavily tattooed women, women who are fat, women of all body shapes and sizes, feeling that burlesque and the rise of it is a space for empowerment, a space where they can do a tease, whether that could be kind of classic cheesecake stuff or it could be fire eating and other forms of kind of grotesque burlesque as well. There's different forms of burlesque influenced by body modification, circus, freak show and that kind of stuff. So there's this kind of space for more women to kind of perform in a safe space. So you get a few burlesques saying this isn't a gentleman's club, this burlesque is for everyone, it's we're not there for someone to get kicks out of, we're not there for someone to get sexually excited over over what they see on stage, because we're it's kind of it's still a tasteful tease, but again an emphasis on tease. So yeah, there's been a really interesting kind of ways in which the new forms of burlesque came and emerged in the 1990s onwards, quite subversive, quite alternative. However, through my research, I found that there are issues at the subcultural level, as well as the kind of mainstreaming of burlesque from the 2000s onwards, that has massive implications on possibilities around femininity.
Thank you for this fantastic potted history of burlesque and erotic performance, which to me is fascinating, having observed bits of it in the early 2000s in East London, hanging out with actually some of the people who were the performers that you write about. The revival, as you say, it's something that was kind of so integrated into mainstream popular culture that a lot of the conversation that you develop in the book was very difficult to grasp from there and then. Mm-hmm. But before we get into the case studies, and bearing in mind that your work is mostly ethnographical, I think it would be great to spend a moment thinking about the title and some of the classifications and definitions that you set up. So your book, I have to say, the title in, I mean, I've wrote down the title in my notes wrong a number of times. So the title to confirm is Bad Girls, Dirty Bodies. I had written down Good Girls, like automatically, so many times. And of course, this is the play that you introduced with all of this, but it goes way beyond, and issues of dirt actually are far from trivial. So it would be great to hear your take on how you see those terminologies playing out, and maybe to go into some of the details of what it is that female sexuality in performance does in relation to those terms.
I love the fact that you replaced it with good girls. Because it's interesting, though, because, again, you know, good girls are usually come first. And what Bad Girls, Dirty Bodies does is bring bad girls to the forefront, saying, you know, these bad, dangerous, dirty, slutty, kinky women are actually sites of power, possibility and success. And again, these words, the bad and the dirty, have texture, they have taste, they have bodily effects as well. So when we think of dirt, you know, you're revolted by something, or someone might be turned on by the dirty. So the dirty and the bad have different kind of meanings, but it has texture, you know. And and also, you know, when we're thinking about dirtiness, one can revel in dirtiness. One could be pigeonholed as being bad, dirty, society, you know, socially corrosive, but actually you like it that way because you are upending or challenging wider norms around, you know, what you're supposed to do with your body. So the bad and the dirty are alluring. They're also there as terms to censor sexual women too. And they're sticky categories as well. So the bad, the dirty are also used as terms to shut people down. I think this is a really important thing for us to kind of highlight here. So it's women who take up space as well, who are put, you know, thinking about who's bad and who's dirty, and, you know, to try and censor them. You know, folk might put these bad women, or women who might not be heterosexual, they might be kinky, they might even just take up too much room in society, or they might shout back at people catcalling them. Any kind of taking up a space, sluts, sex workers, bisexuals, kinky folk, the trans community, all of these contexts can be seen as you know, kind of bad forms of femininity or dirtiness, because these elements might contravene particular norms around gender, around what one can do with your body. So again, the bad and the dirty can be taken up in and explored in different contexts. The book itself looks at kinky women, kinky cis, queer women. So again, it, you know, the bad and the dirty and the dangerous can be explored in different forms. And again, these terms, the bad and the dirty, are applied to a range of contexts and individuals. So again, for the context of this book, the vehicle into debates around bad women and dirty bodies is burlesque, and it's mainly the main case studies kind of focus on women who defy the commercial clean image of burlesque through applying filth, porn, same-sex desire and kink. And again, although those labelled as bad, dirty, too much, too old to do that, too sexual, too kinky, might be kind of shouted down by dominant culture and value systems, the women in this book upend and challenge these kind of a negative perception. So when we're looking at the kind of history of what is bad and what is dirty, it comes back to kind of social context, the church, the idea of the family, binaries, you know, man and woman, heterosexual marriage, that sex can only be something that is valid when you're making children. So again, kind of these ideas around what is distasteful and what is bad and corrosive and polluting kind of social norms has a history. So if we look back at kind of the Victorian period, you had this obsession with cleaning up the streets, you know, putting in these sewage systems, but also it is about cleaning up morality, and there was this kind of crystallization around genders within the 1800s. And you've got this idea of, you know, the church and the family are sacred. Anything that disrupts that needs to be incarcerated. You need, you know, someone who defies that is someone that needs to be fixed. So this idea of, if you're gay, you've got to be fixed. You know, there's something mentally wrong with you. Obviously, I don't believe that. But, you know, these kind of ideas that there's a perfect goodness, and it's around godliness, it's around the family, it's about heterosexuality. But also you've got this kind of standardization of, OK, this is the measurement of the good. If you are at the opposite end, you know, we need to make sure that you become good because there's something wrong with you. So this idea of the good and the bad has a history also in psychiatry within the growth of the hospital. All of these institutions that still have an impact today. Yeah. If you look at kind of burlesque and the commercialization of burlesque, or also kind of kink as well, there are mediated tasteful forms that are okay. But if you go down the street, you know, in a gimp suit with nipple clamps, you know, you're probably seen to be someone who is not necessarily good. You might be seen as quite dirty, quite subversive. And again, you know, it's based back on these kind of assumptions and these socially constructed categories that have a history and still have an impact today. I'm not too sure if the GIMP example.
Yeah, I was always thinking. I mean, I live in East London, where this kind of site wouldn't really be all that out of place. But I think this takes us into a really interesting area, which maybe will come out if we get into some of the case studies, yeah. And that's the question of the category of dirt that you evoke so powerfully being productive in a certain type of resistance and creation of alternativities. In the context of my own lived experience, sexual categories never appeared to me to be as contested to the extent that you just described. Maybe it's a matter of, you know, where and how I grew up.
Yeah.
So I wonder, maybe we could use this as an opportunity to get into some of the extremes, because we set the scene with the revival of burlesque, which is all very nice and clean, and now we've jumped into dirt, which you placed in a very rich historical context, but I think it'll be great to give our listeners some idea of what it is that we mean by some of the dirty behaviors. The first case, big case study in the book of the performer called Miss T, I thought was a really rich illustration of some of the things that we might want to pay attention to see that the mainstream is actually not accommodating of this kind of gimp suit behavior that you just alluded to.
Yeah, Miss T, with her lived experience, a really interesting case study. I mean, she grew up feeling as if she wasn't, feeling as if she couldn't belong anywhere. And actually the fetish community, the BDSM community, was a space for her to be herself without having to justify who she was with, what she did with her body, what she wore, where she felt that externally in some kind of gay and lesbian clubs that she would be policed, that because she's very femme, very pin-up, that that image would undermine her sexuality, and people would question, are you a straight tourist? Are you, you know, sitting on the fence? Are you actually bisexual? So for her, kind of fetish and BDSM clubs was a space where she could just be. And within these spaces, she had the opportunity to explore her performance art. So she did a lot of kind of burlesque performances that invited women in the audience to fancy her. And it's, you know, in kind of mainstream burlesque, although the fourth wall is broken with Miss T, that, you know, she would invite the audience to interact with her. She would invite the audience to desire her because she desired you. So this kind of breaking of the fourth wall was quite subversive. And again, with her performances, she would interlink kind of fetish and BDSM acts within the striptease itself. And I've got to be really careful how I describe the performances, because Miss T has been anonymized. But again, kind of fetish BDSM and other forms of striptease and lap dancing were used within her performance, which you wouldn't generally see mainstream forms of burlesque, because again, there is that slight distance between the audience and the performer. Also, there is less explicitness. So within Miss T's performances, there was explicitness of kind of orgasms, you know, this explicitness in terms of, again, fetish and BDSM.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Maybe it would be good to place this in a little bit of a context. Terms like BDSM and fetish intermingle with burlesque quite freely. And I think it's important to place this particular case study and others in a context of the kind of audiences which they read. So my reading of your case study of Miss T is that she's a reasonably young performer and someone who chose to go into the BDSM and fetish scene quite early on in her life, with a particular interest in that building up a certain identity for her and allowing her a certain set of freedoms. Mm-hmm. So I think it will be important to place this within a certain subculture, and you know, to not necessarily giving up the names of the clubs and club nights, but to understand what kind of a community it is that she's attracted to.
Yeah, I mean, the clubs that she kind of frequented would be spaces where folk can wear particular forms of clothing. So if you look at kind of latex clothing, inflatables, you know, outfits that perhaps if you went to a mainstream club, there might be some negative confrontations with people dressing in a way that isn't kind of your jeans and t-shirt. More interesting types of outfits that are planned, DIY kind of aesthetics. But in these kind of spaces, you'd get individuals who would dress in a variety of ways that would perhaps invite, in terms of mainstream culture, negative reactions, or kind of reactions where people are gawping at particular outfits if someone's in a full gimp suit, you know, kind of head to toe in latex. In these clubs, you have trans and non-binary folk as well who feel that it's a safe space where they're not judged. They might not identify as kinky, but the clubs that the research was engaged with, and you know what Miss T kind of explored, would be a space for a variety of individuals to go and just feel like they're not being judged. So this includes people who like to dress up in different forms of latex attire. It could be folk from the trans and non-binary community, feel safe in the space and not judged. You also have in the space not only a dance floor, but a dungeon. And in the dungeon, you'd have a range of equipment where safe, sane and consensual play are happening between consenting parties. So this could be someone could be being whipped. So there is a range of kind of spatial context within these clubs where you can go to pose in your beautiful outfits, where you can dance on the dance floor, where there are performances on stage, like, you know, Empress Star, for example, has performed at massive fetish clubs like Torture Gardens, where there is a mix of fashion with BDSM and kinky play as well. So there's playrooms. In these spaces, a variety of people come to these clubs for a variety of reasons, and it is a form of a safe space for a variety of reasons as well. And in the case of Miss T, it was a space where she could, you know, be scantily clad and not be touched. It was a space where she could be queer without other folk questioning her intentions or her identity. And it was a space for her to explore her sexual identity and desires through the type of burlesque that she did. And again, this type of burlesque kind of combined the traditional kind of fan dances, but with fetishy elements to it. So latex, like bondage and discipline, you know, all of these themes were interwoven within her performances. And she would invite, you know, the audience to desire her. Whereas in other kind of mainstream burlesque spaces, and there's no issue with this, you know, if someone wants to kind of have a classic performance, that's cool. What the issue is for me is when folk are kind of demeaning to women like Miss T, who see their burlesque as dirty, when actually it's dirty in very good ways and subvertive ways. But, you know, unlike traditional revivalist burlesque, Miss T invited desire, and although there is a kind of fourth wall in all forms of kind of burlesque performance, or the fourth wall is broken, sorry, kind of sexual desire isn't really invited within the mainstream kind of context, whereas with Miss T there was this active desire to be desired, and it was okay for you as an audience member to desire her. So this idea of same-sex attraction and wanting that person on stage because they want you was something that she tied into her narrative of her performances.
Well, this is really interesting, and I was struck in this particular case study with, and to me this is beginning to be a bit of a paradox in forming this kind of safe space. But there is, to me, a tension between wanting to be safe and also wanting to push boundaries at the same time. And I think that's encapsulated to a certain extent by the difference between the bad girl and the dirty girl. Yeah. And it strikes me that maybe the bad girl is a label that one can take on for oneself. You'd certainly say that Miss T feels happy with that kind of label, whereas the label of a dirty body is both pejorative but also liberating at the same time.
Yeah, and again, you know, when we're thinking about kind of these spaces of possibility, you know, these spaces of possibility open out, you know, areas where women take up space in ways that they feel that they can. One of the kind of issues are there only these particular spaces that women can do this and, you know, feel and be valued? And actually the book looks at ways in which the bad and the dirty need to continue to be visible in spaces beyond kind of accepted spaces. Because again, you know, when we're thinking about upending and challenging norms, if you want to queer them, that queering process needs to happen continually and not just in one or two spaces. I mean, Miss T talks in the chapter about, you know, how, you know, some spaces she'd feel more comfortable performing in. However, if she was performing in a, you know, a more mainstream vanilla event, you know, obviously Taylor, some of her performances to that venue, but she said she would never feel that she'd be shouted down. And actually, talking about this idea of opening up space, but also that, you know, the binaries of kind of spaces closing identities or voices down, it reminds me of in the first chapter where I explore Doris Latrine, who is a burlesser who burlesses bulimia. And she, in one performance that she did in Birmingham on Valentine's Day, the reactions that she got from the audiences, who I think is quite a mainstream venue, I think they were expecting very traditional cheesecake, very kind of safe forms of burlesque. And she was the penultimate act, and she pushes on stage her golden toilet Len, and she does a striptease. And within a striptease, she's talking about, you know, her life story. She's talking about burlesquing bulimia. She's narrating her identity on stage. And instead of the kind of big reveal being at the end, you know, the nipple tassels and the twirling of them, it's her retching into the toilet. And around in the audience, people were getting up and walking away. You had dudes behind myself and one of one of Doris Latrine's friends who was saying, what the hell is going on here? That's disgusting. And, you know, she felt this massive resistance towards her story on stage and this idea that, you know, you're not beautiful enough. You're too old. This is, you know, this performance is just disgusting. It has to be pretty. We're not here for your life story. We're here for your tits, you know. And she talks about this in the second chapter, where I talk about just before we go on to Miss T, about how, you know, she feels that there are only certain spaces that she feels safe to perform at, even though she knows that these kind of events that are mainstream are also events that she needs to put her story out at to take up space. However, those wider norms, and it's not just about the stylistics of classic burlesque or audiences, mainstream audiences wanting to see a particular type of form of burlesque because they want to be entertained. It's about misogyny. It is about, you know, it tells us a lot about sexism. It tells us a lot about folk not wanting to hear women's stories, not to hear their identity. It also kind of explores and highlights, you know, what bodies does society frame as desirable or being desired, which feminist voices count. And in the, you know, in terms of burlesque, this is supposed to be a space, especially in the revival, for all voices and all women to be valued, but that's not the case. I mean, when Doris Latrine came off stage, one of the performers just absolutely, you know, demeaned her and said, you know, that what the F was that? What type of performance was that, coming from a performer who looks exactly like Dieter von Teese, who's a brilliant performer? But if there's a repetition of ideals around what's beautiful and what's kind of, you know, subversive, empowered burlesque striptease, that those norms, those discourses start to replicate those wider norms around binaries, around what bodies and desires are acceptable or not. So actually, through the vehicle of burlesque and these interactions from Doris Latrine through to all the case studies, it tells us a lot around how women take up space, but also the context that they're battling against and the ways that they're subverting and navigating these wider discourses that frame kind of, you know, contemporary femininity in very specific ways and in very kind of clean ways. And women who contravene kind of the mainstream cleanliness of norms around, you know, sexually empowered women and what that means. Anything beyond that is seen to be dirty and morally corrosive and not worth focusing or valuing. So the book itself is an intervention into that, to say actually these mainstream clean mediated forms, although they're, you know, it's great, but actually these dirty subversive bodies and femininities are ways to upend patriarchy, are ways to challenge norms, are ways to see gender as a myriad of things. It's queer.
That's absolutely fascinating, and I'm glad that you bring up Doris Latrine. I had a pleasure of seeing her speak in another event, and I was very happy and very touched to see that she is indeed by the standard of these kind of works. She's older. Mm. This is not someone in her 20s and 30s experimenting. Mm. This is a person in her early 50s, and I think that for me was testament to the political importance of this work. Mm. And I want to ask you whether you see this as a kind of success case, success story. One of the big case studies in the book is of the burlesque and trapeze artist Empress Star, who might be known to quite a few of our listeners because she is a, you know, international phenomenon. I have to say that even I have a personal connection. I could not have guessed this when I was picking up the book. Empress Star is a name I knew when I was in my mid-20s, but I was quite shocked to see that in the book, Empress Star, and you name check someone I actually used to live with. And there is a scene with balloons that is very graphic. And I mean, anyhow, I was there when one of the most outrageous aspects of Empress Star's performances were being discussed and made in the mid 2000s. But anyhow, I'm interested to see how you see Empress Star, who is both someone who created the identity through participation in fetish spaces like Torture Garden, yeah. but also found wild commercial success. Yeah. You know, we're talking both the underground and we're talking the circus. Yeah. We're talking an incredible span of yeah. audiences and modes of expression. So it'd be great to hear.
Yeah, I mean, Empress Starr is just phenomenal. I know her work now is slightly different to the work that this book focuses on. But yeah, she's a phenomenal aerial circus artist, cabaret theatre performer, show director and producer. And the work itself that the book focuses on is her work in the early to mid-2000s. So The Queen of the Night is one of the stellar performances that I had the pleasure of watching several times. And actually, you know, Empress Starr said in the interviews that, you know, this was one of her most fun performances to do. And she also positions this show as seminal. And in the show, you've got Empress Starr coming on stage in this beautiful black ruff, long cloak. And, you know, she comes on and in a crystal ball and a cackle, a blow-up sailor, a blow-up doll in a sailor suit is thrown on stage. And her striptease is, again, it's ridiculous, it's ludicrous, it's queer, it's brilliant in its in the way that it navigates the absurd, and how the use of the absurd for her, with her undressing to a strap-on, to her doing a bit of fire eating, and then fucking the blow up doll on stage in very comedic ways. The absurd, the jester, the comedy involved in that highlights the ridiculousness of binaries, of ideas around dirtiness. And what's quite funny about and great about Empress Starr's work is that, you know, it highlights that when we're looking at identity, when we're looking at people's moral belief systems, they're laughable. You know, that you know, people's perceptions of subversive things, what people do behind closed doors, whether it's kind of same-sex sex or whether it's kink, mainstream or wider norms can paint a really ridiculous picture of what's happening in, you know, non-vanilla kind of relationships. And actually, you know, it's pointing the finger back and laughing at those misconceptions and saying, actually, you know, Empress Starr isn't, you know, doing an erotic performance with a blow-up doll and the Queen of the Night. What she's doing is quite clever in terms of making that act absurd, highlighting its construction, highlighting it as a form of entertainment, and, you know, throwing that extreme back in the faces of the audiences. And if you're shocked by that, then maybe that's something that you need to work through in terms of your own moral disposition, because what's on stage is entertaining and fun. But it is that what's interesting about Empress Starr's work, and again, this is a kind of twisted cabaret to even her kind of beautiful striptease on the trapeze, on her really massive chandelier, where she, you know, pulls a diamond out of her pussy. All of this is, again, you know, it's beautiful, it's horny, it's in your face, it's entertaining, it's all of these things. And it's not, you can't just read Empress Starr in one way, and if someone does, that kind of highlights their own kind of moral standing point that has absolutely nothing to do with the context that Empress Starr is kind of playing with. But her use of the orifices, her use of shock, and again, Empress Starr says she's not there to shock, but she's there to entertain. So again, this idea, if someone is shocked by what she has done in, you know, the Queen of the Night or other performances, that's very telling of the kind of wider gender norms that structure norms around the body. What is art? What is burlesque? What women can and cannot do with their bodies? So Empress Starr and the Queen of the Night, that seminal performance is, again, a really interesting vehicle into kind of queering norms. And again, she talks about the gesture in the chapter. She talks about how in her position as an artist, she's able to kind of highlight inconsistencies in the world, just like the jester in the court used to be, where they wouldn't have their head chopped off because, and they could poke fun at the king or queen because that was, they occupied that space. And what's great about Empress Star, she's built up this amazing reputation, you know, of being, you know, a phenomenal aerial artist, circus performer, and a shocking performer as well, with some of her amazing, and I love all of her cabaret stuff. I think she's wonderful. But she's in a position where she can do that. She occupies the space of the jester, where she can highlight those inconsistencies. And the difference between her and the first case study, Miss T, is that Miss T does it as a local kind of cultural practice, which is brilliant. But she doesn't make a living out of it, and she can't occupy the space that Empress Star has and has made a career out of, you know. And in terms of Empress Star taking up space, you know, she takes up space in a different way that Miss T hasn't been able to, for a variety of reasons. But yeah, Empress Star is wonderful. I'm a fan.
I mean, I was able to see one of her early performances from that period as well, and I was impressed. And
which one was that?
I think it might have been Queen of the Night. But see, this was at a point where a whole crowd of people of that whole ilk were designing the work in a living room that I shared with these performers. So it didn't really make such an impression on me at the time, because, you know, someone extracting a balloon out of the anus was just kind of
every
daily
day.
Occurrence.
Every day, toast and yeah.
But I think what actually thinking about this and my maybe quite a blasé attitude to it at the time puts me to think of another dimension. And maybe crudely we can ask you to explore this through the difference between Miss T, who I see as inhabiting a very different politically temporal sphere.
Yes.
So this is a local community in which individual relationships really matter. There isn't a commercial aspect to what Miss T does to that extent. Mm-hmm. And there is also an advantage of us now being in 2020 and a very different discursive landscape around those things than, say, 2005.
Yeah.
So we're looking at, on the one hand, with someone like Miss T, again, these kind of transgressions and performances as a explicitly political practice that's aimed at the individual involved.
Yeah.
Whereas Empress Star, possibly, I mean, I can't speak because I never interviewed her at those times, but I did not witness the cabaret scene and the burlesque scene of the mid-2000s as being inevitably political. I mean, Empress Star and you talk about the rise of the experience economy, and there is a blaring of those lines. Mm. You do credit Empress Star with wanting to push boundaries, but there is a subtlety. There's a subtlety in which the political agenda and the ability to reach wide audiences are being traded off. Mm. And there's no really, I don't imagine there's a way to judge one against the other, but maybe there's something we can take on from just the time difference. Like, what's happening? What's the evolution? And what do you see as still being productive and worth dwelling on in those spaces?
Well, I think, you know, although there has been kind of contextual changes in, you know, 2020, although you know, the Me Too movement has happened, there are, you know, the same issues that the book highlights are still present today, because, you know, women's bodies are still policed in terms of fetish and BDSM and other types of kind of performance art relating to these concepts, not just about burlesque, but other forms of political acts, political standing points. Women are still being doxxed. They're still being harassed online. You know, women's identity. And I don't know, it sounds like I'm giving, you know, putting women in all one category. And I mean, it's so complex, and that it all depends on a myriad of intersections when we're talking about, you know, who has space to take up, who has benefited from the Me Too movement, from women being addressed as sexual consumers, because, you know, it's very particular types of women who've benefited on the backs of others. But I think, you know, there are still massive issues around how society values forms of resistance. So, for example, if you're looking at bad girls, dirty bodies in a contemporary context, if you look at the kind of the commercialization of BDSM and fetish and burlesque, it's still mediated. You won't get a mainstream film that I'm removing kind of 50 Shades of Grey because it's an awful film, and it's abusive and it's not BDSM, but you won't get a mainstream film that would look at kind of queer burlesque. You wouldn't get a mainstream film or even a recording artist who would do a bit of BDSM or burlesque and end up with a same-sex partner in the video. I mean, you've got an example like Christina Aguilera, I'm Not Myself Tonight. In that, it's a beautiful video, you know, really horny video, really kind of kinky video. And you've got her, you know, dreaming or having a fantasy of having domming a woman, wearing all these kind of kinky latex outfits, having, you know, a sex party, having multiple partners. But actually, at the end of the video, it's all a dream. And she's just there in the bedroom with a boring bedroom with her boring boyfriend, you know. And although there are elements of the bad and the dirty and subversiveness, there's a limitation in terms of the mainstreaming, in terms of the commercialization of particular elements from subculture, which is seen to be palatable for, you know, kind of commercial ventures. But actually, the narratives around gender, what gender is, what femininity or masculinity is, what sexuality is, or what forms of sexualities or genders are accepted, very much still mediated. And again, you know, if we kind of expand to kind of representations of bisexuals in films, it's still, and TV shows, bisexuality is still quite a tenuous sexual identity. And, you know, that's a massive problem, because again, bisexuals have been marginalized for years in the media, the same with trans bodies and the trans community. I mean, there's been great developments with independent kind of producers and shows giving a trans voice more space. However, you know, still in the mainstream, you've got these kind of tragic stories and no happy ending stories relating to the trans community, lesbians, you know, gay men. And, you know, there's still a limitation to what's visible in the mainstream. So although that some of the contexts have changed since the book, the themes that the case studies engage with, and it's not necessarily about the performances in terms of burlesque, but it's about what they're saying about gender, what they're saying about the body, what they're saying about sexuality, what they're saying about the issues of heteronormativity, you know, those issues are still prevalent now. And that, you know, we need to continue to push and queer and see the value in disgust as well, and see the value of these bad women, these dirty bodies, as sites of power, possibility and success.
Well, that's an impassioned rallying cry. Thank you. I don't know. I didn't mean it as a joke at all. No, it's a fantastic manifesto, and the book does read like a very impassioned manifesto for pursuing the kind of practices that you observe in the book, and it's quite reassuring in the end to see that actually both the more transgressive and the more commercially viable have contributions to make into this kind of discourse. So I want to ask you to end how you've continued this research, and I've having shared research seminars with you, I've heard some exciting terms.
Awesome. Yeah, so I'm still kind of focusing on, and I'm, you know, still invested in exploring the value of dangerous forms of femininity, the bad and the dirty. And over the last couple of years, my research focus has still been the same in terms of focusing on marginalized forms of femininity, and it's moved into exploring the professional dominatrix as entrepreneurs. Over the past couple of years, I've been engaging with pro-doms, also writing research bids to try and get some funding to explore, in collaboration with pro-doms, pro-dom voice and entrepreneurship. So what's important about this work is, again, you know, with when we're thinking that, you know, women are supposed to have more freedoms, actually, you know, pro-doms are experiencing a lot of barriers around work. Pro-doms aren't seen as entrepreneurs, but they are. These women are fantastic businesswomen. They wear many hats. They have a range of professional skills and experiences that can upend, can challenge heteropatriarchal culture. So there's something very significant about professional domination and framing, and what it could mean to frame pro-doms as entrepreneurs. I have interviewed a couple of pro-doms of the last year or so for a paper that explores pro-dom voice and entrepreneurship. The bid is looking at collaborative ways of bringing voices in and working in collaboration with pro-doms to challenge those, not just challenging negative perceptions of particular types of work, but also framing these women as experts in a variety of contexts beyond the networks that they engage with, socialize, etc. So that's where I am at the moment in looking at pro-doms as entrepreneurs.
Gosh, that's a fascinating field, which has the potential to cross quite a few different research agendas. Mm-hmm. Well, good luck with that for sure.
Thank you.
Gemma, thank you so much. Thank you so much for this conversation and indeed for your research.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Bad Girls, Dirty Bodies, Sex, Performance and Safe Femininity by Gemma Kamane is published by Bloomsbury. I'm Pierre Delancer and the editor is Marshall Poe. Thank you for listening and join us next time.